Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, the term white fragility was coined by the Seattle-based educator and author Robin DiAngelo. She defines it as, quote, a state in which even a minimum amount of racial stress becomes intolerable, triggering a range of defensive moves. These moves include the outward display of emotions, such as anger, fear, and guilt, and behaviors such as argumentation, silence, and leaving the stress-inducing situation, unquote. DiAngelo's new book is White Fragility: Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism. Her book and this talk are perhaps the necessary starting place from which the beneficiaries of systematic racism and institutional power can begin to correct that injustice. With humor, hard-earned knowledge, and humility, DiAngelo illuminates the issues we face as a culture and points to highly relatable methods of repair. Robin DiAngelo received her doctorate in multicultural education from the University of Washington. Her area of research is whiteness studies and critical discourse analysis. She has been a consultant and trainer on issues of racial and social justice for over 20 years. DiAngelo spoke on June 28th at the Seattle Public Library's Central Library. We're presenting our broadcast/podcast version here. To listen to the full event, go to kuow.org/speakersforum. Please note, this talk contains unedited language of an adult nature.
My name is Misha Stone, and I'm a Reader Services Librarian in the Reader Services Department. And before we begin this evening, I would like to acknowledge that we are gathered together on the ancestral land of the Coast Salish people. So together, let us honor their elders, past and present. We thank them for their stewardship of this land. Welcome to the library, and thank you for joining us for this reading with Dr. Robin DiAngelo. DiAngelo's essays and talks have been so important and revelatory to me. I know that I'll be reckoning with my own internalized racism, with my own socialization, and trying to reduce harm throughout my entire life, both personally and professionally. And what I love about the book, White Fragility, is that it crystallizes so much of what I've heard her say and write all in one place in a way that I can continue to move through it, continue to reference it. So we're all here tonight for White Fragility, and there's a lot of buzz about this book already. It's only been out for 2 days. And I think it's testament to the fact that this topic's time has come. Poet Claudia Rankine said, Robin DiAngelo's White Fragility brings language to the emotional structures that make true discussions about racial attitudes difficult. With clarity and compassion, DiAngelo allows us to understand racism as a practice not restricted to bad people. In doing so, she moves our national discussions forward with new rules of engagement. And Michael Eric Dyson, who wrote the lovely foreword, called it a vital, necessary book, a bracing call to white folk everywhere to see their whiteness for what it is and seize the opportunity to make things better now. Please welcome Dr. Robin DiAngelo.
Thank you so much. Okay, that was such a rush. before I launch in, the way I'm going to do this is I'm going to read a little bit, riff a little bit, kind of guide you along with some slides. But I do want to reiterate that this talk is happening on the ancestral territories of Indigenous peoples. And I believe very, very deeply that if we don't know our history, if we cannot trace the past into the present, we cannot explain current conditions in ways that are transformative rather than victim blaming. And I think today it's very, very clear when we see struggles around water rights at Standing Rock, the Duwamish yet again denied federal recognition, which denies treaty rights and sovereignty. These struggles are never separated from the present. At the same time, a piece of white fragility is that white people are not taught their history. We don't know our history. So I want to acknowledge that. I want to position myself, of course, as a white person, and I'm talking to a very, talking and addressing a very, very specific dynamic. This is arguably the most complex, nuanced social dilemma since the beginning of this country, and there are myriad roads in, and all of them are essential, but so consistently left off the table is whiteness. Right? So we often learn about this group and that group and their struggles and their triumphs and their heroes and heroines, and yet we don't ask ourselves struggles and triumphs in relation to whom, right? And so again, I'm going to focus on white folks and white people. I do use humor, and I want to say a little bit about why I use humor. Some of it is my style, and also because there's so much tension and so much anxiety and so much charge and so much defensiveness and on for white people around race that we can, when we begin to get challenged, we can shut down really quickly or glaze over or tune out. And all of those, of course, function to protect our positions and hold our worldviews in place. And so the laughter can help release some of that. If we can laugh at this, and mock it a little bit, to be direct, it can help us then step back and not take ourselves so seriously and hopefully, again, open it up. And I want to say that this is killing people of color, right? This is very, very serious. So my humor is not meant to trivialize that, but it is a strategy, one of many that I use in order to try to air this out and open it up. So I want to start by reading a bit from the beginning. White people in North America live in a society that is deeply separate and unequal by race, and white people are the beneficiaries of that separation and inequality. As a result, we are insulated from racial stress at the same time that we come to feel entitled to and deserving of our advantage. Given how seldom we experience racial discomfort in a society we dominate, we haven't had to build our racial stamina. Socialized into a deeply internalized sense of superiority that we either are unaware of or can never admit to ourselves, we become highly fragile in conversations about race. We consider a challenge to our racial worldviews as a challenge to our very identities as good moral people. Thus, we perceive any attempt to connect us to the system of racism as an unsettling and unfair moral offense. The smallest amount of racial stress is intolerable. The mere suggestion that being white has meaning often triggers a range of defensive responses. And these include emotions such as anger, fear, and guilt, and behaviors such as argumentation, silence, and withdrawal from the stress-inducing situation. These responses work to reinstate white equilibrium as they repel the challenge, return our racial comfort, and maintain our dominance within the racial hierarchy. I conceptualize this process as white fragility. Though white fragility is triggered by discomfort and anxiety, it is born of superiority and entitlement. White fragility is not weakness per se. In fact, it is a powerful means of white racial control and the protection of white advantage. In my early days of work of what was then termed a diversity trainer, I was taken aback by how angry and defensive so many white people became at the suggestion that they were connected to racism in any way. The very idea that they would be required to attend a workshop on racism outraged them. They entered the room angry and made that feeling clear to us throughout the day as they slammed their notebooks down on the table, refused to participate in exercises, and argued against any and all points. I couldn't understand their resentment or disinterest in learning more about such a complex social dynamic as racism. These reactions were especially perplexing when there were few or no people of color in their workplace, and they had the opportunity to learn from my co-facilitators of color. I assumed that in these circumstances, an educational workshop on racism would be appreciated. After all, didn't the lack of diversity indicate a problem, or at least suggest that some perspectives were missing? Or that the participants might be undereducated about race because of scant cross-racial interactions? It took me several years to see beneath these reactions.
At first, I was intimidated by them, and they held me back and kept me careful and quiet. But over time, I began to see what lay beneath this anger and resistance to discuss race or listen to people of color. I observed consistent responses from a variety of participants. For example, many white participants who lived in white suburban neighborhoods and had no sustained relationships with people of color were absolutely certain that they held no racial prejudice or animosity. Other participants simplistically reduced racism to a matter of nice people versus mean people. Most appeared to believe that racism ended in 1865 with the end of enslavement. There was both knee-jerk defensiveness about any suggestion that being white had meaning and a refusal to acknowledge any advantage to being white. And over time, I began to see what I think of as the pillars of whiteness, the unexamined beliefs that prop up our racial responses. I could see the power of the belief that only bad people were racist, as well as how individualism allowed white people to exempt themselves from the forces of socialization. I could see how we are taught to think about racism only as discrete acts committed by individual people, rather than as a complex, interconnected system. And in light of so many white expressions of resentment toward people of color, I realized that we see ourselves as entitled to and deserving of more than people of color deserve. I saw our investment in a system that serves us. I also saw how hard we worked to deny all this and how defensive we became when these dynamics were named. In turn, I saw how our defensiveness maintained the racial status quo. And none of the white people that I identify, whose actions I describe in this book, would identify as racist. In fact, I think they would most likely identify as racially progressive and vehemently deny any complicity with racism. Yet all of their responses illustrate white fragility and how it holds racism in place. These responses spur the daily frustrations and indignities people of color endure from white people who see themselves as open-minded and thus not racist. This book is intended for us, for white progressives who so often, despite our conscious intentions, make life so difficult for people of color. I believe that white progressives cause the most daily damage to people of color. And I define a white progressive as any white person who thinks he or she is not racist, or is less racist, or is in the choir, or already gets it. White progressives can be the most difficult for people of color because to the degree that we think we have it, we're gonna put all of our energy into making sure you think that we have it, and none of it into what we need to be doing for the rest of our lives, right? White progressives do indeed uphold and perpetrate racism, but our defensiveness and certitude make it virtually impossible to explain to us how we do so. So I'm pretty sure I'm speaking to a room filled with white progressives. So let me just be clear, you are not the choir. There is no choir. I am not the choir. When I say there is no choir, it's because my learning will never be finished. And this moment I think I'm the choir, I think I'm going to be done and I'm going to have certitude. I often joke, but on some levels it's kind of true. When I first applied to be that diversity trainer back in the early 90s, I thought, well, of course I'm qualified to lead discussions on racism. I'm a vegetarian. How could I be racist? Now, I would need to be vegan today, but, you know, in the 90s, that was pretty alternative, right? I even got called a communist once when I said, no, I'm a vegetarian. But, you know, my point is I just thought it was all about open-mindedness and alternativeness. And let me just say that, you know, I love Seattle, and everything I learned about white fragility, I learned here working with white progressives. So, chapter one, challenges to talking to white people about racism. All right? I have never met a white person who did not have an opinion on racism, have you? If you are not sure that all white people have opinions on racism, just bring it up the next time you're around a bunch of white people. Maybe tonight when you have a drink in Ballard after the talk. And see how that goes. Not only do we all have opinions, but they tend to be very emotionally charged, and that has nothing to do with whether they're informed or not. I have an opinion on virtually everything, but that does not make them informed. I don't believe you can grow up or spend any significant time in the United States without developing opinions on racism, and they will be emotional and strongly held. And again, that has nothing to do with whether they're informed. And in fact, if you are white and you have not devoted years of sustained study, struggle, and focus on this topic, your opinions are necessarily very limited. And no, a trip to Costa Rica, multiracial nieces and nephews, right? These are not sustained study, struggle, and focus. Now, how can I say that when I don't know most of the people in this room? And this, of course, is the first thing that tends to trigger white fragility, generalizing about white people. As a sociologist, I'm really comfortable generalizing about white people. Social life is predictable and patterned, you know, in really observable ways, and we've got to grapple with those patterns. But I can say this, that your opinions without sustained study, struggle, focus, mistake-making, relationship building, repair, they're superficial because nothing in society gives you the information you need to have more than that. In fact, you can get through graduate school in this country without ever discussing racism, can you not? You can get through teacher education in this country without discussing racism. And if you have if you're in a progressive teacher education program, you'll have one required multicultural education class. But that doesn't mean you'll be talking about racism. You might just be talking about how to introduce ethnic authors in February. Right? You can get through law school, you can get through social work, right? You can be seen as qualified to lead a major or minor institution in this country, to lead a group of people, to supervise people. You can be seen as qualified to do those things with virtually no ability whatsoever to engage with any complexity or nuance in the issue of racism. Can you not? All right, so that is the first challenge, humility. The second is individualism. Apparently white people do not understand socialization. Because we really think that we are exempt from it. And of course, the irony of that is because we're socialized to value the individual. We put a lot of effort there, but we think that, you know, just because I say I am or want to be, I could be exempt from these forces. So that is another challenge. And again, generalizing, suggesting race has meaning for white people will often trigger white fragility. We think if we don't see it, it isn't there, and you haven't explained it to me yet enough so that I understand it, so I'm not really sure that could be valid. Okay? And we tend to use our reactions as a way out. There is no way we're going to get where we need to go from a place of white comfort. And I am comfortable racially virtually 24/7. So that is not my goal, but we will often use that lack of comfort as a sign that something's been done wrong rather than something probably has been done right. And that we need to use that as a way in to the deeper framework that would cause such upset rather than use it as a way out. And we don't understand racism as a system. So this is another key challenge, which leads me to chapter 2, which is racism and white supremacy. Racism is a system, not an event. Right? And it's the system we're in. And none of us could be, and none of us were exempt from its forces. But the way we're taught to think of racism functions beautifully to not only obscure the system, but to exempt us from its forces, right? Or to have us believe we are exempted from its forces. Now, as a white person, I was raised to be racially illiterate. And I actually think all white people are raised to be racially illiterate in this culture. And in gaining racial literacy, I have had to understand not just the collective dynamics and dimensions of racism, but how racism impacts different groups who are perceived and defined as people of color, how it impacts them differently, right? So not all peoples of color experience racism differently. The things I've internalized about different groups is different. Where and how they are positioned always in relation to whiteness or far away from whiteness, and how that manifests, right? All of that must be understood. But after a good 20 plus years of talking day in and day out to white people about racism, I feel very confident to say that there is something profoundly anti-black in this culture, and that nothing seems to turn white people's cranks of resentment like thinking black people got something over on us that they didn't deserve. And the deeper belief is that they're inherently undeserving. I believe in the white mind, black people are the ultimate racial other, right? And that there are these bookends. And again, your perceived proximity to each end of that impacts how you're going to experience your racialization. So having said that, and not really having time to do history, I just want to give you one glance at the trajectory of anti-blackness in this country since its beginning, and this slide will be deliberately dense. We can literally think about it as state-sanctioned, organized crime, but at least discrimination against African Americans from the beginning. And it starts with kidnapping and 300 years of enslavement, torture, rape, and brutality, and it carries on. And about a quarter of the way in, you see bans on testifying against whites, which made it technically legal to murder black people in this country, and you are now in my lifetime. And I'm going to say it again because, again, a lot of white people seem to think it ended a long time ago. We are in my lifetime about a quarter of the way through that slide. And then we see about two-thirds of the way through employment discrimination, and we are in 2018 with copious empirical evidence. Right? So let's pick it up there. Employment discrimination, educational discrimination, bias laws and policing practices, white flight, subprime mortgages, mass incarceration, the school-to-prison pipeline, disproportionate special ed referrals and punishments, testing, tracking, school funding, biased media representation, historical omissions, and so much more. It is a system, not an event. It's the system we're in, and none of us could be, and none of us were exempt from its forces. If we want to be unique and special individuals, then we need to figure out how whatever we see is special and different about us set us up into that system, because it did. So I'm talking, I know white people really well. I'm talking X, and you're like, ha, I was Y, right? Okay, you were Y, most whites are X. How did Y set you up? It did. Right? The question is not if, it's how. Okay. I'm going to repeat it. It's a system, not an event. And how do we cope with the moral trauma of what I just read to you? Right? Resmaa Minnikin has a beautiful book, My Grandmother's Hands, where he talks about racial trauma. There's a trauma, I believe, to white people of racism, but I don't think it's a moral trauma, right? And it's a piece of white fragility, not being able to face our complicity in this system. Well, historically, we projected our sins onto the black body, right? Lazy, shiftless, criminal. We projected our sins onto the black body. Today, in addition to doing that, we obscure the system of racism that we uphold, and we exempt ourselves from its forces, right? And we do this in a way that appears to be progressive, right? That race doesn't matter to us. This is the board after the Grand Champion College Jeopardy round, right? And for me, it just speaks volumes, right? Not again, knowing our history and being able to trace it into the present is one of the volumes it speaks. Another one is, that is the history of this country. It is not their history. It didn't happen in a vacuum. So One of the aspects of institutional power is the ability to disseminate your worldview to everyone, to position it as objective and universal, right? And to tell the story, right? The story of the other when we are not in relationship with the other. Right? So I want to give you an example of the power of the story. And I want to do it through the Jackie Robinson story. You all know Jackie Robinson? Right? So Jackie Robinson has been quite celebrated for doing something. What's the tagline that goes with Jackie Robinson? He broke the color line, right? Now, so let's do a little discourse analysis. Because every year on the anniversary, we celebrate him breaking the color line. So think about what that invokes, right? He was exceptional. He was special. He did it. Finally, one of them had what it took to break through and play with us. Up until him, nobody had what it took. So subtext, inferior group, right? But he did it, and of course, the day he did it, the day he broke the color line, racism in sports ended. So imagine if we told a story like this. Jackie Robinson, the first black man that whites allowed to play Major League Baseball. And I want you to notice the difference in that story. One, that's the truth. It didn't matter how exceptional he was, and I actually don't believe he was the first most exceptional. But if we didn't say he could play, he couldn't play. If he walked out onto that field before we said you can walk out on the field, the police would have removed him. It wasn't up to him, right? Now, the reason I want us to tell the story the second way is one, because it's true, and two, because I need role models, right? How did white people get organized? What did they do behind the scene? What barriers did they face? What challenges, right? What strategies did they use? And could we use any of those today and adapt any of those today? Right? It's not about me wanting to point out how bad white people are. Right? So chapter 3 looks at racism after the civil rights movement. And after the civil rights movement, it made a brilliant adaptation. So post-civil rights, racism got reduced to the following formula. A racist is an individual who consciously does not like people based on race and is intentionally mean to them. Always an individual, must be conscious, must be intentional. And that definition exempts virtually all white people from the system of racism. This definition, I believe, is the root of virtually all white defensiveness on racism. Have you guys noticed any white defensiveness on racism? Yeah. It makes it virtually impossible to talk to the average white person about the inevitable absorption of a racist worldview that we get from being socialized in a racist culture in which white supremacy is the bedrock. Because you suggest that anything I have done is racially problematic in any way, and I'm going to hear a question to my moral character, and I'm going to need to defend my moral character. Right? And we've probably seen this a million times, right? So that definition actually functions to protect racism, even as it looks like progress, right? Racism became bad post-civil rights. This sets up what I think about as the good-bad binary, that kind of, it's either or, right? Racists are bad, not racists are good. And we know how to fill that in, don't we? Ignorant, bigoted, prejudiced, mean-spirited, definitely old. And when we die off, there'll be no more racism. You know, I've been working with a lot of these tech companies that when I walk around, I think to myself, God, I guess you have to be under 30 to work here. And I'm telling you, they cannot think critically about race. And the people of color that work with these young people are in so much pain, right? No, I get asked all the time, do you think young people today are less racist? Oh, actually, the question usually begins with, don't you think? And just a heads up, if you approach me with, don't you think, the answer is no. Because that's not an open question. But no, I don't actually think young people today are less racist, or because that consciousness hasn't changed their outcomes. In fact, they're getting worse. Right? Okay. So Southern for sure, don't you think? Around here, I'm pretty sure they live in Fife. I never been to Fife, but on the way to Tacoma, I see Fife. I'm like, ooh, boy, it looks like racists live there. And when I'm on my way up north, it's like Smoky Point. Okay? All right. Not racists are good. We're educated, progressive, open-minded, well-intended. We're young. We're northern. We live on Finney Ridge. But we're all moving to Portland really soon. Because Whole Foods is so corporate now. Again, this is the root of virtually all white defensiveness, and it just functions so beautifully to exempt us. So we just have to get rid of it. And when white people hear me and they feel angry and pissed off and defensive, can I just say this now that you guys are loosening me up here? When you laugh at my jokes, I'm going to keep getting looser and looser. Damn, white people are pissy about racism. We are so pissy on this topic. We're mean on this topic, right? And so if you're sitting here feeling that, just see if it isn't rooted in this definition. And if you cannot let go of this, you're just not going to be able to move forward. So aversive racism is a form of what sociologists call new racism, right? And so it's racism that progressive whites are most likely to hold, but because it conflicts with our identities as good people, we're most likely to be in denial about it. So let me find that piece. It's a manifestation of racism that well-intentioned people who see themselves as educated and progressive are more likely to exhibit. It exists under the surface of consciousness because it conflicts with consciously held beliefs of racial equity and justice. Aversive racism is a subtle but insidious form, as aversive racists enact racism in ways that allow them to maintain a positive self-image, e.g., I have lots of friends of color, I judge people by the content of their character, not the color of their skin. And whites enact racism while maintaining a positive self-image in many ways. For example, rationalizing racial segregation as unfortunate but necessary to access good schools. Rationalizing that our workplaces are virtually all white because people of color just don't apply. Avoiding direct racial language and using racially coded terms such as urban, underprivileged, diverse, sketchy, and good neighborhoods. Denying that we have few cross-racial relationships by proclaiming how diverse our community or workplace is. And attributing inequality between whites and people of color to causes other than racism. Consider a conversation I had with a white friend. She was telling me about a white couple who she knew who had just moved to New Orleans and bought a house for a mere $25,000. Of course, she immediately added, they also had to buy a gun, and Joan is afraid to leave the house. I immediately knew they had bought a home in a black neighborhood. This was a moment of white racial bonding between this couple who shared the story of racial danger and my friend, and then between my friend and me as she repeated the story. Through this tale, the four of us fortified familiar images of the horror of black space and drew boundaries between us and them without ever having to directly name race or openly express our disdain for black space. Notice that the need for a gun is a key part of this story. It would not have the degree of social capital it holds if the emphasis were on the price of the house alone. Rather, the story's emotional power rests on why a house would be that cheap. Because it's in a black neighborhood where white people literally might not get out alive. Yet while very negative and stereotypical representations of blacks were reinforced in that exchange, not naming race provided plausible deniability. In fact, in preparing to share this incident, I texted my friend and asked her the name of the city her friends had moved to. I also wanted to confirm my assumption that she was talking about a black neighborhood. I share the text exchange here. "Hey, what city did you say your friends had bought a house in for $25,000?" She replies, "New Orleans. They said they live in a very bad neighborhood and they each have to have a gun to protect themselves. I wouldn't pay 5 cents for that neighborhood." I reply, "Oops. I assume it's a black neighborhood?" "Yes. You get what you pay for. I'd rather pay $500,000 and live somewhere where I wasn't afraid." I reply, "I wasn't asking because I want to live there. I'm writing about this in my book." The way that white people talk about race without ever coming out and talking about race. She had a very interesting response to that. "I wouldn't want you to live there because it's too far away from me." Notice that when I simply ask what city the house is in, she repeats the story about the neighborhood being so bad that her friends need guns. When I ask if the neighborhood is black, she's comfortable confirming that it is. But when I tell her that I'm interested in how whites talk about race without talking about race, she switches the narrative. Now her concern is about not wanting me to live so far away. This is a classic example of aversive racism, holding deep racial disdain that surfaces in daily discourse, but not being able to admit it because the disdain conflicts with our self-image and professed beliefs. Now, readers may be asking themselves, but if the neighborhood is really dangerous, why is acknowledging this danger a sign of racism? Research and implicit bias has shown that perceptions of criminal activity are influenced by race. White people will perceive dangers simply by the presence of black people. We cannot trust our perceptions when it comes to race and crime. But regardless of whether the neighborhood is actually more or less dangerous than other neighborhoods, what is salient about this exchange is how it functions racially and what that means for the white people engaged in it. For my friend and me, this conversation did not increase our awareness of the danger of some specific neighborhood. Rather, the exchange reinforced our fundamental beliefs about black people. Toni Morrison uses the term race talk to capture, quote, "the explicit insertion into everyday life of racial signs and symbols that have no meaning other than positioning African Americans into the lowest level of the racial hierarchy," unquote. Casual race talk is a key component of white racial framing because it accomplishes the interconnected goals of elevating whites while demeaning people of color. Race talk always implies a racial us and them. So folks who have seen me present before know that I use this metaphor, and I do tend to think in metaphors. And as I do the work that I do and I talk on a daily basis to white people, I literally got this image in my mind of a dock or a pier. And what it signifies for me are two things. One, how surface or superficial our narratives are. But also, the dock, if you look from above, appears to be floating on the water. But it's not. There is an entire structure submerged under the water that props that dock up. It rests on literally pillars anchored into the ocean floor. And everything I do in my work is trying to get us off the top of the dock and under there to examine those pillars. Because despite all the bullshit on top of the dock, our outcomes have not changed. Right? So we have to ask ourselves, what's going on? Right? So as I listen to these narratives, I think about them in two overall categories, color blind and color celebrate. Right? So let's start with the first set, color blind. Probably the number one color blind racial narrative is, "I was taught to treat everyone the same." Anybody ever heard that one? Okay. Let me just tell you, when I hear this from a white person, and I hear it frequently, there's a bubble over my head. And it has a few things in it. The first thing is, oh, this person doesn't understand basic socialization. This person doesn't understand culture. Ooh, this person is not particularly self-aware. Right? And I need to give a heads up to the white folks in the room. When people of color hear us say this, they're generally not thinking, all right, I am talking to a woke white person right now. Usually some form of eye rolling, and actually I recently co-facilitated with a black woman who said, that is the most dangerous white person to me. Okay? So it's not functioning the way we think it is, and this is another piece of humility for us. We are the least qualified to determine whether we understand this or not. Right? Because so often the things that we think convey that are not conveying that. And all of these are within that, you know, it's in the past, you know, just everyone struggles. My parents weren't racist, that's why I'm not racist. Oh, my parents were racist, that's why I'm not racist. Doesn't matter really what we say first, what comes next must be I'm not racist. So-and-so just happened to be, but it has nothing to do with race. And it also has nothing to do with why no one in the office gets along with her. And this is another one I actually ask white folks to remove from their vocabulary. Oh, by the way, along with reverse racism, which there's no such thing. Right? All right. Remove from your vocabulary anything on the topic of race that begins with just happened to be regardless, including that your neighborhood just happened to be white. Right? Yes, but at the human level, when we make that move, right? Get race off the table and let's position some kind of shared universal experience. There isn't one in this physical plane that we live in a society deeply separate and unequal by race. So I call these colorblind because they basically say, I don't see it, and if I see it, it has no meaning. And there's a question that has never failed me in my efforts to uncover how we pull this off. And that question is not, is this true or is this false? Because if we apply that question, we're going to argue and argue and argue. The question that has never failed me is, how do these narratives function in the conversation? How does it function? And if we ask that question, we can see that all of these narratives function to exempt the person from any part of the problem. All of them take race off the table. All of them close rather than open the exploration. And in doing that, all of them protect the current racial hierarchy and the white position within it. It doesn't have to be your intention. And I'll just be blunt. I'm not interested in your intention. I'm interested in how this functions. What is the impact of these narratives? They are closers, not openers. Well, probably the folks in this room, we're beyond color blindness, right? What do we say? Right? We say things like this. Oh, I work in a very diverse environment. If we can't say that, and many of us can't, we'll come up with some kind of proximity. Okay? I have people calling my family. Me? I'm not racist. You live in New York. This one will get used interchangeably with I'm not racist. I'm from Canada. I'm not racist. I'm from Hawaii. I'm not racist. I'm from Europe. I'm not racist. I was in the military. Apparently, there are no racism in any of those places. When I hear that one, I used to live in New York, I was thinking, oh my God, you walked by people of color and didn't lose your shit? That's amazing. Okay. So how many of you in a conversation with a white person have heard some version of those narratives right there, those three? Okay. All right, and if we're gonna be really honest, we've said some version of these narratives. That last one, sociologists actually have a term for it. It's called the inoculation case. I've been near people of color and it stripped me of my racism. And I want you to notice how often white people invoke proximity as evidence. This is important because it helps reveal what's under the dock. It helps reveal what we think racism is, that we would invoke proximity to show that we're not racist. And I need to understand what I think racism is if I'm going to unpack my role in it, right? So let's do some discourse analysis. Let's think critically about these three narratives. When a white person invokes one of these narratives in a conversation about racism, they're giving you their evidence, right? Racism comes up, I say this, this is my evidence. In my mind, what's that my evidence of? What do I want to make sure you know? I'm not racist, all right? So, in order to be good at evidence, it must distinguish me from a racist. So apparently, a racist cannot do these things, or this wouldn't be good evidence. So a racist cannot work three cubicles down from a person of color. Could not have people call their family and would find living in New York intolerable, even though I could think of at least one racist that lives in New York. So Now, I have yet to let go of that little joke because I do enjoy it, but it does rest on the good-bad binary. I'm on the same continuum the person I'm thinking of is on. Just want to be clear about that. Okay, so I'm going to just ask a rhetorical question to the people of color in this room, and I'm going to look at my dear friend Aisha over there and Paula, and I'm going to say, could a racist work three cubicles down from you? Hell yes. All right. People of color, do you have white people in your life who you love deeply? And who on occasion reveal their internalized racial superiority, their internalized racist assumptions about the world? Other white people, do you hear that? Could you even be married to them? And they could still? It doesn't disappear the day they fall in love with you? Okay. All right. So I hope we, I mock it a bit because it's ridiculous, right? But it's so ubiquitous. So we really just got to ask ourselves, well, what do I think it is, and what am I saying, and how is that functioning, right? And clearly this rests on that simplistic definition. Apparently a lot of white people think that a racist cannot tolerate any proximity, even the sight of people of color. And so if there's any friendliness across race, there cannot be racism. This is another thing that makes us so difficult in these conversations. So I'm just going to put it right out here. As a result of being born and raised as a white person in this culture, I have a racist worldview. I have deep racist biases. I have developed racist patterns. And I have investments in a system that has served me very well and is very comfortable for me and really helped me get over sexism and classism that I struggle with. And I also have investments in not seeing any of that for what it would mean for my identity and what it would require of me in action. Right? I didn't choose it, don't want it, got it. And it's actually incredibly transformative and liberating to begin from that premise. So that you can begin to think, well, how's it coming out in me? So that I might be able to stop that or ameliorate that rather than it's not coming out in me. I sometimes think if I went into the bathroom and I came out and the back of my dress was hiked into my pantyhose and my ass was showing, I sure hope you'd let me know. And I wouldn't say to you, how dare you suggest my ass is showing? And you better proceed as if it isn't. And yet, you know, the worst fear of a white progressive is that we're going to say or do something racist, but by God, don't you dare say that I just said or did something racist. Rather than, thank you. You know, I didn't see myself doing that, and now I can do something different. All right, I was in the Peace Corps. I marched in the 60s. I voted for Obama. I'm on the equity team. We could go on. I already know all this. I told you I've been to Costa Rica and tutored there for a week with the little children. And this is a real Seattle one. We don't like how white our neighborhood is, but we had to move here for the schools. What could we do? I think it's very disingenuous. I think we do like how white our neighborhoods are. And that's another conversation. All right, so these are not colorblind. These are color celebrate. I love it, right? And I'm going to just say this. I love it in the right doses. I like it in the Montessori school with the children of the international workers that come from Microsoft. So again, If we apply the same question, not true, false, or right, wrong, but how do these narratives function in the conversation, we get the same answer. They all exempt the person from any part of the problem. They all take race off the table. They all close rather than open. And they all protect the current racial hierarchy and the white position within it. They're actually in practice and impact not any more progressive. And they have not changed our outcomes. So we have to get under here and see what's going on. And what I think is going on, what I think of as the linchpins of new racism, right, is the good-bad binary, and that one's really effective, deep implicit bias, which you can't help but absorb, this precious ideology of individualism. At the same time, this idea that we don't speak from any particular position, but speak for all of humanity. And people of color speak for their group, and when we're interested in hearing about that, we'll ask them, but we'll cover everything else, right? Any people of color get asked to be on the equity team automatically when it's not even necessarily your interest or, okay. Internalized superiority, which you cannot help but have if you are raised white in this culture. And in some level, an investment in not seeing this. And finally, the power of segregation to hold it all in place. The profound, I think for me, the most profound message of all is that I could call a white neighborhood good. I could call a school filled with all white teachers and white children a good school. That the fundamental message is that there's no inherent value in the perspectives or experiences of people of color. So these messages are raining down on us relentlessly, 24/7, and we don't have umbrellas. And nothing could and nothing did exempt us from their forces. It's on us to figure out how they shape us, not if. Right? So all of this sets up some patterns. Right? Preference for racial segregation, lack of understanding what racism is, seeing ourselves as individuals, not understanding that we bring our history with us. History matters. It's a history of harm. Assuming everyone is having our experience, arrogance, lack of humility, unwillingness to listen, right? Dismissing what we don't understand, apathy towards racial justice. You know, after, again, 20 plus years, I think most white people are pretty apathetic about racial injustice. Inability to, or lack of interest in sustaining relationships with people of color, wanting to jump over the hard personal work and get to solutions. Confusing not agreeing with not understanding. Is it possible that you're not actually informed enough to disagree? You ever had somebody say, no, you misunderstood? What if the person understood you perfectly? In fact, they even understood what you meant, and you don't understand how what you meant comes from a racist framework. A need to maintain white solidarity, right? That's the unspoken agreement amongst white people that we'll keep each other comfortable around our racism. Highest priorities, saving face. I always like to say, you know, when I do a caucus group or something and the white people are afraid I might think they're racist. I think you're racist. I do. I think I am too, right? But yeah, let's be done with that. And actually your carefulness and your hiding yourself and you're not contributing to the conversation won't actually change that assessment at all. And people of color don't find that to build trust.
Thanks for streaming this episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Robin DiAngelo's new book is White Fragility, Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism. She spoke on June 28th at the Seattle Public Library's Central Library. Thank you to SPL for our recording. We present what we can in the broadcast podcast hour of Speakers Forum. If you want to hear more, go to our website, KUOW.org/speakersforum. While you're there, check out other great Seattle area talks, subscribe to our podcast, follow us on social media, and share your comments. Tune in again soon.